102.7 FM CFRO. My name is Reg Argue. I have in the studio with me this morning Sarah Bjorknes from the War Resisters. Thank you for coming in this morning, Sarah.
Thanks, Reg. Good morning.
And first thing I'd like to ask right off the bat, Sarah, is that at this time in the Canadian Federal Parliament, there is a trying to introduce legislation which would help the war resistors from the United States who are escaping the unjust war of Iraq and heading up here to Canada to help them stay. How can the ordinary person help out to persuade federal members of parliament in the way of members of the Liberal Party or NDP party or any federal party member?
Well, as you say, there's a motion sitting waiting to come before parliament that was passed by the Standing Committee on Citizenship and Immigration in December and can be brought up pretty much any time for a vote in parliament. And that motion has two parts. The first part is demanding that the government create a program for war resistors to be able to stay in Canada so that they don't have to go through the refugee system one by one, that they could be considered as a particular class of immigrants and, like others before them, be given the opportunity to come to Canada for a period of time and then be allowed to apply for citizenship. And the second part of the motion is that until that program is in place, that any deportation acts against the refugee claimants whose refugee claims have been so far denied, that any deportation action be suspended against them until this is the issue is settled. So that was passed by the committee in December, and it was brought to Parliament in January, and so is in line to be brought up among other pieces of legislation to be voted on. And we have the NDP and the Bloc Québécois firmly on side. And of course, we have a minority government, and so we need the Liberals, and we need key Liberals to be on side on this as well. On that standing committee, all the Liberals on that committee voted in favor of the motion. We've had public affirmations from many Liberals that they support this motion, including Bob Rae, who until the by-election doesn't actually have a seat, but is a prominent Liberal and critic of foreign affairs. He's in support of war resistors. So we need really the big ones, Stéphane Dion, who we haven't been able to confirm his support yet, Mauricio Balavacqua, who is the immigration critic, has said that he supports it, but they're not necessarily going to go out of their way to convince their colleagues to support this. It's up to us to do that. So here in Vancouver, some of the key members that we want to make sure we have on our side are Raymond Chan in Richmond, Ujjal Dosanjh in Vancouver, and Hedy Fry in downtown Vancouver. They're the three key ones that we want to get to. So anyone who's a constituent of these members should be phoning and asking to meet with them and expressing their opinion on this so that they know what their constituents feel about this issue and so that we can ensure that we have the majority vote that we need when the motion does come forward.
And I'd also like to add that anyone out there listening in other areas of Canada, please contact your member of parliament, because this issue does need to be dealt with, and we do need to allow this legislation to pass because of the fact that the Iraqi war was not approved by the United Nations. And for anyone to stand there and say, well, the Iraqi war was just, it wasn't just. Because of the fact is, you look at the way the United Nations has always gone after people for war crimes. Well, one of the biggest persons responsible for war crimes at this time is just to the south of us. It's the Bush regime. And you take a look at what's going on in Iraq. You have over 1 million Iraqis that have been killed. You have anywhere from 15 to 30,000 Americans, soldiers that have died. That's the official number they're given right now is about 40, a little over 4,000. But the unofficial number, you have to take in consideration that the soldiers that are injured in theater and then die on way to Germany or even the United States, and then all of a sudden you're coming up with a number that's anywhere from 15 to 30,000. And it's amazing how the politicians will spin it a different way, and yet the real truth, if people found it out, it would amaze people. And I just ask people to just take a couple minutes out of your day today or tomorrow or the next day, and just call some of your friends and ask them to get involved with this, so that we were able to create a grassroots movement that helps the people from the soldiers from the United States that don't want to fight in this unjust war. Let's start showing what Canada is supposed to stand for, because let's remember what Trudeau, how he stood against the Vietnam, and he allowed war resistors at that time to come in here and stay. Why can't we go back to that way of thinking? And at the same time, as a veteran of the Canadian Armed Forces, I call for the removal of the Canadian troops who are now in Afghanistan. I do not support the war. I'd like to see my brothers and sisters brought back to Canada where they belong, and the money put back into social programs and infrastructure programs. And also with that, Sarah, you have a protest coming up on March 15th. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. This is, we're coming up, unfortunately, to the fifth anniversary of the beginning of the war in Iraq on March 19th. And so around the world, March 15th has been chosen as the day for collective action, it being on a weekend. And Saturday here for us and across Canada and across the United States, people will be mobilizing. In Canada, we're calling it World Against War. And of course, because of the timing and the anniversary of the Iraq War, that is the primary focus. But there's unfortunately so many additional military issues. And so we're also calling, along with many citizens of Canada who are formerly from Iran, to stop any kind of action against Iran, which is, you know, for the last few years has really been simmering and has flared up recently. We want our troops out of Afghanistan because we don't believe, and we know that the Afghan people, if they were truly asked, know that this is not the best solution for them. And as always, for so many years that has gone on, the occupation of Palestine, and particularly at the moment the siege of Gaza. So these are the focuses of the World Against War rally, which will be held at noon at the Vancouver Art Gallery, and it'll be starting out with music by DOA.
And also, with your dealing with the war resistors from the United States, could you share with our listening audience just some of the stories that have been shared with you in regards to what they've had to face down in the United States when they told their commanders that they don't want to go fight, that they're conscientious war objectors?
Sure. Some of them didn't even know the term conscientious objector, even though there is provision in the American military to make a conscientious objector claim saying that you are against all wars. And so some people didn't even go through that process because they didn't know it was there for them. Nobody let them know. Others attempted to make those claims and made application and were unsuccessful, the claims were buried, or they were told you just can't, even though in fact they could, and they weren't approved. Others didn't even bother to go through that process, just came out openly and said, you know, this is how I feel, this is what I see. Even those who did not serve in Iraq had the benefit of those around them who have come back and are telling the stories, who either they themselves are horrified about what they did, or they're not, and they're bragging, and those who are awaiting their deployment are hearing about the atrocious behavior that is caused when soldiers act collectively, and are asked to commit these kinds of war crimes, and so they just said, "No, we're not going to participate." Some have had the support of their families, because, you know, quite frankly, their family probably didn't support them going into the army in the first place, but it was an economic choice for them, depending on where they lived. Others have unfortunately had their family turn against them actively by reporting them when they were going to come across the border, and by openly disowning them. And so it's a really tragic situation for those who have support in the United States, but of course they can't go back. And often it's far too expensive for their families to come here. So the kind of support that they can get is, you know, is pretty limited. And then there's those who have nothing, who feel they have nothing to go back for because they have no support, because, you know, the political climate where they come from, they just, they're, as far as they're concerned, they're on another planet. They just don't get it, and they don't understand what they've done.
Yeah, and there was one point that Paco from the Military Families Organization of Victoria that he made. Brad McCall did a show over in A Small World on Commercial Drive, and Paco was saying that a lot of Canadians don't realize what the Canadian military was like, you know, back a long time ago. And being someone who served from 86 to 95, and I went over to Iran in 88, I can actually tell people that I know stories, and I've met people that have actually lost friends due to suicide. There was one warrant officer, the only reason why he's still alive is because his wife jammed her finger in the trigger and prevented the rifle from going off. There was another gentleman who drove his vehicle into the garage and hooked up his tailpipe to a pipe and then put it in the back of his vehicle, and he ends up, he's dead. And there is also even a relative of my wife who was also in the military, and he served for over 20 years, and he joined the military underage, and after he got out of the military, he ended up committing suicide. There's been this problem with even in the Canadian military that we have to address, because what happens is you have institutions, as Paco was saying, that what happens is they're breaking these people down and then they're rebuilding them, they're programming them. And us as a society here in Canada, we should start looking at it going, well, is there a way to do it that we're not going to cause harm to someone? At the same time, we need to start institutionalizing programs in place which help people when they start to ask for help. Rather than laughing at them and turning, you know, turning your back on them, why can't you help the people? Because there are so many people in the military when I was in that were screaming for help, and yet there was nothing there. So it's just amazing, it just mind-boggling to me. But when I went to Brad's show over at A Small World, there was a lot of points that were brought up. That just, I sat there in the back and I was listening to what Brad has to say, and I was listening to what Paco has to say, and I was listening to what Sarah and many others had to say. And I am truly honored to be near this organization because of the fact is they're starting to, they realize what's going on. And it's like people are starting to wake up. And I'm honored to be even near this organization. And with that, we have to go over to our next guest. This has been Sarah Bjorkness from the War Resisters. This is Wake Up with Co-op, Co-op Radio 102.7 FM, CFRO. Our next guest is going to be Stuart True from the Council of Canadians. Hello, Stuart.
Oh, hi, Rich. How are you doing?
Great. Right off the bat, I'd like to ask you about the military pact that has been signed between the United States and Canada. In some semi-secrecy?
Yes, certainly. Well, it appears on February 14th, the Canadian Canada Command and U.S. Northern Command signed a civil assistance plan. This essentially allows Canadian troops onto U.S. soil and vice versa in times of so-called civil emergencies. And this can be anything from a natural disaster to, for protection of critical infrastructure and whatnot, and also to potential terrorist attacks. So this was signed, I suppose, quietly, because they didn't really announce it in Canada. And when we phoned up Canada Command to ask why, they said that they had no intention of putting out a press release, and that, in fact, the order had come from higher up not to do so. So, I mean, to us, this seemed like another example of Harper's secrecy around issues when it comes to the United States and these kinds of security and military pacts that they're increasingly signing through things like the Security and Prosperity Partnership.
And also, I was reading a news article this morning, and what it talked about was, in the article, that the American military does not like to put its troops under command of another nation. So the scary point to me brought up in this article was that if the American troops do enter up into Canada, there's a possibility that these troops may possibly still be put under the command of the American government, so it would be like foreign troops are now occupying Canadian soil. Is that possible?
Yes, it's actually, that's exactly how they, Canada Command, put it when they talked to the press eventually. There was an article that went around CanWest papers on the pact, and they admitted that while the Canadian military will have kind of tactical control, the U.S. troops will remain under U.S. command. It's by law they have to remain under U.S. command. But I think the most dangerous part of this is the idea of militarizing civilian response essentially to disasters. I can't imagine a situation where you would necessarily need Canadian troops, let alone American troops, to come and aid in a civil response. For instance, a terrorist attack is a police incident, right? It's a crime, and you would think that you would require a police response. But I'm not sure why we actually signed this agreement, what use it is.
And also, you were talking about the Tillman Agreement on your website, Council of Canadian website.
Mm-hmm.
And already British Columbia and Alberta have signed that agreement. And on your website, you were talking about Ontario. Could you tell us a little bit about why the Council of Canadians is against the Tillman Agreement and how it's going to seriously affect the ordinary people and also even the unions within Canada?
Sure. Well, I mean, Tillma, is kind of bringing NAFTA down to the provincial and municipal level. So whereas under NAFTA, foreign corporations can challenge Canadian rules at the provincial and federal level that they feel hurt their profits, Tillma actually allows local companies in one province to challenge the municipal or provincial rules, any rule actually, in the other province that they feel unfairly hurts their profits. So the fact that they're granting, I think, corporations this enormous power, it's a de facto corporate bill of rights to challenge any government regulation that gets in the way of profits. And this can be even rules and regulations that are there to protect the environment, for instance, or to protect health care.
Also, here in BC, there was a proposal of putting in 5 pipelines between Alberta and British Columbia to help with the transfer of, allegedly help with the transfer of the crude oil that's being produced now in Alberta, and it's going to be brought over to BC and then shipped out through the ports. I asked this question to members of the provincial NDP party and others. What's the possibility of one of those pipelines being used to transfer British Columbian water over to Alberta because of oil sands? They need so many barrels of water to produce so many barrels of oil.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not sure exactly about the possibility of it, but I don't think it would be out of the question considering the extreme water shortages that Alberta is actually facing, and considering that oil sands production is set under the Security and Prosperity Partnership to expand by about 5 times. So clearly, because it requires, I think, 3 to 5 barrels of water to produce 1 barrel of oil, and because Alberta is running out of water very quickly, there's going to be a lot of pressure to bring down water, say, from the north of Alberta or from other provinces, for instance. So I wouldn't put it out of the question, and I think it's another example of why Canada not only needs a national energy strategy, but also a national water policy that would actually ban the bulk move of water. yeah, exactly.
And also on your website, there is talk of a member out of Quebec, out of the government out of Quebec, has put forth recommendations on how to erode the public health care. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, there's probably others here who could do a better job, but there has been a report recently put out in Quebec that that called for a major increase in private delivery and private financing of health care, and of even inclusion, get this, of the word freedom as kind of another component of the Canada Health Act. And we've seen things like this, and this is exactly the way that public health care was dismantled in Britain, for instance, where by gradual erosions of the public system. And I think there's a real danger that when you start getting into increased use of private insurance and private clinics, that it really opens the door to complete privatization, essentially an American kind of system, especially when NAFTA comes into play and says that you have to afford national treatment to U.S. companies. For instance, U.S. HMOs and other private insurers would actually have the same rights under, once Canada goes down that direction, they would have the same rights as Canadian health insurance providers to the playing field, I guess, to the marketplace. And so I think it's very dangerous. It's something that we have to be fighting very strongly, is this erosion by the provinces, especially in BC and in Quebec, of the public health care system.
And also, under the SPP, as an artist myself, I've written a bunch of stuff. Would the intellectual rights be owned by the corporation, or would the artist be able to retain the intellectual rights?
I'm not sure if they've gone into that amount of detail. Out of Montebello, they did come up with a intellectual property action plan. And this is, I mean, to us it seems a lot like, and with the looming introduction of a new copyright law in Canada, I don't know if you've been watching, Michael Geist has got this incredible campaign. He's fighting overly strict copyright rules that would essentially ape the U.S. system here in Canada. And I think there is a danger that these kinds of reforms will be handing, I think, too much of the rights over to, for instance, the film and music industry, and not necessarily helping artists in the way that you would imagine stronger copyright laws do. And so I think that definitely through the SPP and through recent pressure from the U.S. ambassador in Canada, there seems to be this push in Canada to basically grant more power and more royalties to U.S., large U.S. film and music industries while not necessarily protecting Canadians.
Well, Stuart, we only have 2 minutes left, so I'm going to give yourself about a minute just to say something in closing. If you could share something with the listening audience, it's really important that the Council of Canadian is wants to wake the listening audience up towards.
Well, sure. I guess I mean we could talk about the upcoming New Orleans summit. There's the next Security and Prosperity Partnership summit, which is the fourth, will take place in New Orleans from April 21st to 22nd. And to this point, there has still been no public debate about the desirability or necessity, you would say, of Canada-U.S. integration, security integration, and economic integration. And so we're once again calling on opposition parties to raise this issue in the House of Commons and calling on Canadians to actually pressure their MPs to make this an issue in the next few months, in the next few weeks, actually, leading up to the next summit. We don't think it's right that only corporations have been participating in these SPP summits and that the public has been completely left out. So we're asking Canadians to actually make this an issue with their MPs and their local councillors.
Well, thank you very much, Stuart. That was Stuart True from the Council of Canadians. And I'm going to hand over the last 30 seconds to Sarah, if she would like to share any last points.
Sure. Thanks, Reg. I would reiterate again, while you're talking to your MP about the Security and Prosperity Partnership, you should also be talking to them about war resistors. It's pretty much the same issue of where do we see Canada and what do we want Canada to be doing about issues of militarization and integration with a much larger country. And so I encourage you to speak to your members of Parliament about these issues and ask them to vote with the people, because the people clearly do not support the government's position. And I urge people to show up on March 15th, wherever they are, and here in Vancouver, it'll be at the Art Gallery at noon, to join us in the world against war.
Thank you very much, Sarah. That's Sarah Bjorkness. It's been Wake Up with Co-op. Thank you, everyone, for listening. It's Co-op Radio 102.7 FM, CFRO. And all I can say to people is please take the time to phone your member of parliament, wherever you are in Canada, and help out with the war resisters, and also address this SPP, which is also very unjust, that we should be addressing too. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Have a great day.